This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to Lighthouse Faith Podcast, where we are moving forward in truth and love. I'm Lauren Green, Chief Religion Correspondent for Fox News Channel and author of the book Lighthouse Faith and the new devotional Light for Today. Well, Holy Week is the climax of the Lenten season. It begins with Palm Sunday and will culminate with Easter, the day Christians celebrate the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead after his crucifixion on Good Friday. Now, the secular world has created many images of Easter that have really very little to do with Easter itself, which is the cornerstone of Christianity. Now, the Easter bunny, coloring of Easter eggs, Easter egg hunts, and even the beloved Easter parade and the many beautiful bonnets are things that have taken center stage. They are traditions, but they've moved the actual event of Easter off to the side or even dismissed entirely. But bestselling author and television host Anthony DiStefano has created a children's book that brings the real Easter message front and center by using, believe it or not, the Easter Bunny as his messenger. Now, the book is called The Story of the First Easter Bunny, and Anthony DiStefano joins me now. Anthony, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You know, I usually have contact with you in your role with the Priest for Life, and I didn't know all the things that you had really done. You've written over 25 books, for adults and children alike. What made you decide to write a book about Easter?
Well, I've wanted to write a book about specifically about the Easter Bunny for many years because I was frankly tired of that silly secular rabbit hopping in and taking center stage, as you said, on this most holy of Christian holidays. You know, we have to be very careful about secular symbols. You know, I don't think the Christian churches don't rigidly oppose the inclusion of secular symbols like mm-hmm. the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus in holiday celebrations. They don't rigidly oppose it because it can bring a little bit of extra fun to the holidays, sort of like a spice rather than the main meal. But anyone serious about their faith would have to say that you have to use extreme caution when dealing with these kind of secular symbols. Parents cannot be blind to the fact that there is an ongoing culture war in our society. Our deepest beliefs are under constant and relentless attack. And the other side doesn't hesitate to jump over the heads of parents to propagandize children with their, let's say, their woke agenda. So children are really at the front of the cultural religious war lines here. And in order to make sure that our core religious convictions are not marginalized or compromised, then we have to make sure that the meaning of holy days like Easter have to remain, as you said, in the forefront of any catechesis for children. I wrote my children's book because I thought there was a way to use the Easter Bunny for a deeply religious purpose and to do it in a way that was helpful to parents. Because, mm-hmm. Lauren, I think many parents find it difficult to teach kids about the true meaning of Easter because it involves death,
right,
the killing
right,
of someone.
Right, right.
Death in any form can be scary. But the bottom line is to be able to give kids an idea of what the crucifixion and the resurrection are all about by employing an adorable little bunny in a way that's not frightening, I think can be a valuable tool.
This is so wonderful. And I have to say, you've got a video of the entire book online that people can access. And so it's a very short, you know, story, but it incorporates the illustrations, which is by Richard Cowdery, who's a best-selling New York
yes.
Times best-selling artist. I mean, it's just beautiful, but the video of it actually is just so powerful in that, you know, it has the music and all. Why make the video as well?
Well, I made videos for all of my children's books, and my hope one day is to have these books made into animated cartoons with music. Like when we were growing up, Frosty the Snowman and the Grinch, except have real Christian versions of them. And
Right.
to be using someone like Richard Cowdery, he's absolutely brilliant at giving animals like bunnies human expressions. And after all, these books, they're really about people. We use animals in these books because they're more approachable. They're more adorable to children.
Right,
They're less
right.
intimidating than adults. And Richard has this amazing ability to capture these adorable characteristics. I think had he been living at a different time, he would have definitely been recruited by Walt Disney to work on Bambi and Dumbo and movies like that. But here's the point I'd like to make. The point I'd like to make is that I want to produce Bible-based kids books with powerful storylines and Disney quality artwork, because we're trying to tell the greatest story in the world here. And why shouldn't we have the greatest production values? Too many times, Christian productions, in my opinion, my humble opinion, are very amateurish. And why should we when we're telling the greatest story of all time?
It's really amazing. It really, truly is amazing. I have to admit that, when I first saw the book, it's like, oh, really? Really? And then I read, it's like, oh my gosh, I love this book. And it's my squeaky voice, so I really love it. But what is, do you know the background though of the Easter Bunny? Like, why did it become this tradition of Easter?
Well, there are a lot of different theories about that, Lauren. In pagan times, rabbits were symbols of fertility because, they famously multiply a lot. They
Yeah.
have a very high production rate. And I think that translated into the Christian era because we as Christians are called to be fruitful and multiply. Christ's great commission to make disciples of all nations. And the same, likewise, with eggs. Eggs have always been a sign of a symbol of fertility. So there's that general loose character, that general loose connection. Sometime in the 1600s, 1700s in Germany, they came up with something called the Easter hare, which was sort of like a Santa Claus type character. But there really hasn't been any tremendous connection between the secular character and the religious part of him. In fact, when I tried to think of writing this story years ago, I tried to figure out how I could tie the whole fertility angle in. But since you're writing for children, it's very difficult to do that. You can't write about sex. And so then I hit upon the idea of the large ears and the importance of attentive listening as being a very profound gospel message. And I made that connection instead. I think it's a better connection. And I think it's one that, that may last.
I love the ears, though. He made the ears, he drew the ears and created the ears in such a way that are just so incredibly, you just want to hug them. You just want to like hold on to him. What it's good about it also, I think, is that here you've got an Easter bunny that's not chocolate. It's the one Easter bunny you can get, and the book is thin enough that you can actually put it in an Easter basket for children. But this is really a lot like what happened, to Christmas you talked about, secularization. Santa Claus has real historical roots in Saint Nicholas of Bari. The giving of presents is because we've been given the greatest gift, Jesus. But the story of a baby born in a manger is a story children can grasp and relate to. Like you hinted about this before, but is the Easter story just too difficult for children to understand? I mean, they don't do, the Christmas plays always have the angels and the three wise men, and there are all these characters that you can grasp that children can really perform and really learn the story of Christmas. Easter is a little bit different. I don't know how you put a play on with kids, with Pontius Pilate saying, here's the man, has it been difficult for parents to let kids in on what the real meaning of Easter is so they can understand it?
It's very difficult. It's difficult for adults to fully understand what happened, why it had to happen, why there was a crucifixion, why did we need the murder of God, deicide, in order to make up for the sins of man and redemption. That's a difficult lesson for most Christians to really understand, and it takes years of study to get it. But I think children can understand basic points about it. First, they need to be introduced to Jesus. They need to be introduced to the story of the fact that he was killed, but more importantly, the story that he rose, the fact that he rose from the dead. That's the most important point to give to children. You have to get You get them to know that Jesus was a good man from God, who was God, who died and then rose from the dead. And how do you do that? You know, it's like if you play, you know, if you play the game of pool, sometimes you hit the ball straight into the corner pocket. Sometimes you use a bank shot.
Mm.
A bank shot is you hit the ball off one of the sides and then it goes in. To me, the way you teach children about difficult things involving Christianity is to use these kind of bank shots. And the way I do it in this story is you show everything through the eyes of this adorable, harmless, cute little bunny. He is the one who's watching the crucifixion. He is the one who's seeing the terrible things that have gone on. He is the one who's seeing the resurrection. So children are looking at the rabbit, looking at the crucifixion. It's like they're not directly looking at it, and their first sympathy lies with the bunny. So you're introducing them to this true story, and it's not causing them to have nightmares. But
yeah.
I think the main thing we want to get across to children here, and what I've tried to do in this book, is that, you know, what's the main meaning of Easter? It's the hope in life after death. The fact that death isn't the end of the story. The end of the story is resurrection and life everlasting in heaven. The fact that God could pull good out of even the worst evil. That's the message that all of us need to hear over and over again. And it's a message that kids need to hear very early. Because no matter how much we try to shield and protect children from pain, there's just no way to prevent them from experiencing suffering, from grieving over people and pets in their lives that die. When that happens, they have to be able to grieve in a healthy Christian way. Ultimately, that's the difference between believers and non-believers. Believers don't suffer and grieve any less than non-believers, but they do suffer and grieve with hope. They don't despair. And so that's that gift of the belief in the resurrection in heaven is something we can give our children, and it's a seed I've tried to plant in this book and in all the stories that I've written.
You know, when I was young, we were taught the Christian message, but I don't remember it being very bloody. Do you think that with the movie like Passion of the Christ, the Mel Gibson movie, which we saw so much graphic blood and the whipping and the real nature of crucifixion, do you think that soured a lot of parents on actually talking about the real story of Easter?
You know, Lauren, I don't know. I have no doubt that it did with some of the parents. But at the same time, I think all of that violence impacted a lot of people for their own good, too, because the point of having all of that, the bloodiness and the goriness, is to show how terrible and evil sin is. Christ took all our sins on his back, and sin is an ugly thing. Sin is a evil thing. Death is a terrible thing. And graphically showing that is something that too many Christians in today's world don't think about. I think we've gone maybe in the Middle Ages, it was too much goriness, but we've swung the pendulum the other way, and everything is too sanitized now. Too many churches are concerned about, you know, this mushy message of being nice, and they forget about Christ's redemptive sacrifice and what it cost in order to buy and purchase our sins. So it's a trade-off. And I think that, again, we can't keep children, we can't sanitize life for children. We have to teach them very early that life, no matter how much joy there can be in life, it's still always going to be a valley of tears and a place of sorrows. And the quicker they understand that, and the quicker they understand that that's not the whole story, but that they need to have hope in ultimately life winning out in heaven. I think we're better off telling children that story from the beginning, even if it is a little bit scary.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to take a break right now on Lighthouse Faith Podcast. We're talking with Anthony DiStefano about his book, The Story of the First Easter Bunny. We'll be right back.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
And we're back with Anthony DiStefano. He is the author of many books. His latest book, though, is The Story of the First Easter Bunny. It is a children's book. It's very thin. Like I say, you can actually just put it in that Easter basket when you want to give your kids, you know, the chocolate and the eggs and the, you know, jelly beans and all of those things. But, you know, one of the things that's really very powerful about the book is that the Easter Bunny has a motive. The Easter Bunny is trying to save his mother. And I think that's where the tears start coming, because that is the story of Easter that gives such hope. And, you know, take me into your mindset about why it wasn't just his observing this man he kind of knew that was, you know, on the cross and was risen from the dead, and then but that it became a story about trying to save somebody else.
Yes, well, you know, two reasons. One is you want a story to be compelling, and in order to do that, there's got to be an emotional element. So I wanted there to be some kind of connection, real connection, between the bunny and Jesus. And when I wrote the book and I was trying to think of this connection, naturally the idea of the ears, his big ears, being symbolizing the way Christians need to listen to God. You know, Jesus said many times, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. So the rabbit ears, they came to me very early as a way to connect the bunny and Jesus. But I also immediately thought of the fact that when Jesus was hanging on the cross, the last direct action he took was to entrust his mother to St. John. He said, son, behold thy mother, and mother, behold thy son. Now, of course, there's a lot of theological significance in that entrustment, but it's also true on a strictly literal personal level that Jesus wanted to make sure that his mom would be okay after he died. And I thought that if the bunny in this story had a sick mother, and if he witnessed the crucifixion and heard with his big rabbit ears how Jesus had taken care of his own mother, that that might provide him with an even more poignant reason for visiting Jesus's tomb afterwards and praying the line that I have in the book, which I think is, oh man in the tomb, please won't you be kind, you helped your dear mother, now won't you help mine. In other words, the fact that the bunny has a sick mother whom he loves and is trying to care for and cure, that makes it even easier for him to relate to Jesus, who of course loved his own mother. So that's the main reason I wrote the story in this way, because I think it adds a strong emotion element to the mm-hmm, book, mm-hmm. And one that most people can relate to.
You know, I want to get to some of your other books, because, you know, you're no lightweight when it comes to theology. I mean, you've written children's books here in many ways, you know, the Joseph and the Donkey and that sort of thing. And but you've written on heaven, on hell, prayer, angels around us. What is one of the most powerful of your books that you've written, do you think?
My first book, A Travel Guide to Heaven, is for adults. And it was written 20 years ago, and it's, you know, been sold in, you know, 17 or 18 different countries, and, you know, 11 or 12 different languages, and it's still going strong. It's just, in many ways, it's a deceptively simple book. Some people mistake that for it being the playful tone for being a light kind of a book, but it's really not. You know, I use a travel motif to talk about heaven as if it's like a five-star resort. But mm-hmm. The reason why I'm always partial to this book is because it highlights something that we don't hear as much as we should in the church. And that's that name, that after the resurrection, and we believe as Christians that there will be a resurrection and we will have bodies again, because we're not meant to be just angels in heaven and pure spirits. We're meant to have glorified bodies. And when that day happens, there's going to be a physical component to heaven. And people don't think about that too much. They picture heaven as being white and cloudy and
harps and everything like that. Yeah.
They don't realize that they're going to see their own mother again if their mother has died. And they're going to be able to run up to their mother and hug her and kiss her and feel the warmth of her skin and hear her voice again. And heaven is going to be colorful and it's going to be bursting with life. They don't think about those things. And because of that, they're more afraid of death than they should be. And they grieve longer for their departed loved ones. And so that book, I think, tries to impart a vision about the physical reality that heaven will be one day. And so it's my favorite book because I think it's helped a lot of people.
But I want to also ask about hell. I think one of the things that turns secular people off to perhaps Christianity is this talk of hell. They don't want to think about, oh, I don't want to think about hell. I don't like it that Christians say, if you don't believe in Jesus, you're going to hell and all of that. And one of the things that is very true about hell is that Jesus actually talked about it a lot. And we tend to try to avoid it. But what is it about your book about hell? What is it?
It's an explanation of hell and how it could be real. Because, yes, Jesus talked about it many times. And we know that the demons fell and that Satan fell. And so we know that it's very possible for human beings to fall into hell. Hell really exists, and there are souls there right now. I don't believe in universal salvation because I believe in free will. And if an angel can fall, then certainly a human being can fall. God allowed the angels to fall and become demons. What is he, we're so much his favorites that he won't allow us to fall? So, but people don't have trouble believing that an all good God can create a place that's so nasty. And so I wanted to write a book that emphasized the fact that the people in hell want to be there. Mm. It's possible to turn away from God. We sometimes experience this in our own lives. There are moments that none of us are proud of, when we're wrong about something, but we don't want to apologize. We're stuck in that state of stubbornness we feel venomous, and we want to just boil and stew there rather than doing the right thing. And it actually feels good sometimes. And everyone has felt that experience. But what happens for the people who are in hell is they've made that choice and they're stuck in that choice. They don't want to go to heaven. They want to turn away from God. It's possible to want to turn away from God. And when you turn away from God, you turn away from everything God is. So if God is light, you're in darkness. If God is love, you're involved in a lot of hate. If God is order, then you're in chaos. That's what hell is. It's a state, and also someday after the resurrection, it too will have a physical component to it. And so in my book on hell, I try to flesh those things out and make hell more believable because people don't understand that people go there by their own choice.
Yeah, I mean, C.S. Lewis talked about that in The Great Divorce. I mean, those who are in hell choose hell, and they just have made those choices.
There's a judgment, no doubt. There is a judgment from God, but the judgment that the soul makes is right in line with what God makes. It's the same choice. You know, they choose to be in hell, but at the last judgment, we believe all of their sins are made manifest.
But then the book on angels, the angels around us. Talk about that. Are there angels around us, and where are they? How can we identify them?
I wrote a children's book on this too, called How the Angels Got Their Wings.
Yes.
Angels are pure spiritual beings. They have an intellect, they have free will, but they do not have bodies. So they know things without having to filter everything through brains and synapses and neurons. They see things, and they're beings of great power. God created them just like he created human beings, and they had a period of testing just like we did in the Garden of Eden. And when they were faced with that test to choose God or not to choose God, most chose God, some did not. And those we call demons. And yes, those demons do wish to harm us because they hate God. Sometimes people will say, well, why is the devil or demons, what do they care about us for? What do they care about anything about us? The reason is because they hate God. They hold him responsible for everything that's bad in their existence. They want to hurt God, but how do you hurt God? How do you hurt someone that's almighty and all-powerful? You can't. So what do? You do the next best thing. You try to hurt that which is made in God's image, human beings. And so they do try to tempt us. And whereas angels, the angels that were given to help us by God, try to help us by tempting us to do good. It's all, you know, the whole thing, Lauren, has to do with the fact that there's a lot more to the world than just this physical reality right here. There is an invisible world, and there is an invisible spiritual world. And it's true. It's not make-believe, and it's not pretend, and it's not fairy tale. The most true things in life we can't see. You can't see love. You can't see faith. You can't see goodness, and you can't see spiritual things, beings like the angels. So in all my books, I've tried to present this full reality, not just the reality of what's seen, but the reality of what's invisible, too.
Yeah, you know, but the angels in the Bible, though, have taken physical form. And we see that when the angel of the Lord comes to Joshua. We see that when the angel, I think Gabriel, comes to Mary. And the first thing they say is, fear not. They must be pretty awesome and scary creatures when they first appear to people.
Because they're so powerful. And yes, every time in the Bible where an angel is present in that form, in manifesting their glory, their powerful form, people are afraid right away. And their first line is to say, be not afraid. That's true. But yes, you never know. They can appear in forms that they're not scary either. St. Paul talks about, always be generous to people, beggars. You never know when you're helping an angel unaware.
Right.
I don't like to go overboard. There are some people who are over spiritual and they see angels and demons and the devil as the reason for everything they're doing in life. And those people are wrong too. You have to have a balanced look at the world. Oftentimes we don't need demons to tempt us to do the wrong thing. We have our own fallen human nature to blame for that. And so it is a certain balance that you have to have. And those people that are on one side and just over-spiritualize everything, I think they're wrong as well.
Wow. So once again, the latest book is called The Story of the First Easter Bunny. And where can people get a hold of this book?
To use the proverbial expression, wherever books are sold, it's on Amazon. At Christian bookstores. It's Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. I've been blessed with tremendous distribution system.
And also the video, that the animated version is very, very lovely. Where can people see that?
That's on YouTube. And I think I have a website too. I don't sell books on my website, but you could see all the books I've written, which is close to like 30 books. And if they don't mind my Italian name, the website is www.anthonydestefano.com. And I believe they could see all the videos for all the books there.
Well, thank you so much, Anthony, for being on Lighthouse Faith Podcast. This has really been wonderful, and I would encourage people to get the story of the first Easter Bunny and check out your website, because there's some really wonderful books on there as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lauren. It's great to be with you.
Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. Amazon Prime members can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music app, or just hit the follow button on your favorite podcast player.
And thank you also for listening to Lighthouse Faith Podcast. I'm Lauren Green. Have a blessed day.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow Podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.